Hello and welcome to the Ecom Ops Podcast. We believe that there is more than enough content focused on e-commerce marketing and not enough content celebrating the real heroes of e-commerce, those running the operation. Each week, we find and interview an e-commerce operations expert to share the secrets behind how some of this industry's most exciting businesses are run. I'm your host, Norbert Strappler, the CEO of ThinkSpider.
Hello and welcome to another Ecom Ops podcast. Today, I'm so happy to talk with Luis, a sales enablement strategist and consultant, Federico, who has a really rich background across various sales roles. Bish, who is an entrepreneur and e-commerce expert, and Paul Jarrett, the CEO and co-founder of Bulu. Welcome to the show. I'm so happy to talk with Luis, a sales enablement strategist and consultant dedicated to tech SaaS-based B2B. This is really great to have a real sales guy here who can help us a bit to understand that better. But tell me a bit, or tell us a bit, about yourself and about what you're doing. What is the background? Why sales?
Sales happened accidentally for me, and I ended up being recruited to work on some of the most amazing sales teams for the most amazing companies. I've been recruited to work at companies like LinkedIn, Google, Uber, Tesla. I've also worked for the British Broadcasting Corporation. So I've had this amazing experience selling different products and services to companies all over the world. And I've had an experience that has blown my mind. And I would say that I am entirely unconventional, because unlike most people's perception of salespeople, I'm not sharky, I'm not pushy, I'm not super aggressive. I take a more consultative approach. And I think that's actually what's helped me in my career.
What does a sustainable sales culture mean to you?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think a lot of focus in the sales organization is around performance. And often we are so hyper-nuanced in conversion rates, connect rates, and things of that nature, that we forget that there's a prerequisite to performance, and that's wellness. The ability for a salesperson to take care of their mental and physical health has a direct impact on how much revenue they can produce. And so I would say that when we think about the sustainability of a high-performing sales culture, we want to think about all elements of psychological and physical well-being, and making sure that we're creating training that is inclusive, making sure that we're creating training that also guides reps on how to navigate very difficult conversations, perhaps when they're dealing with irate customers, when they're met with discrimination from customers and things of that nature, or even being able to capture their own unconscious bias in the way that they deal with customers. And so I think that a sustainable culture has to be holistic in its approach and its consideration.
Mm-hmm. How does embracing diversity revolutionize sales and the overall customer experience?
Thank you for that question. I think often we have leaders with these global aspirations, serving billions of people, markets across here and there and everywhere. And we want to think about, as a business, having that strategic foresight to make sure that these customers have the kinds of experience that they expect and they deserve. And that starts within the company. In thinking about at the top, when we assess leadership, we often think about emotional intelligence, EQ, and then IQ being sort of like your intellectual capacity. I think that we also need to start considering cultural intelligence and finding ways of engaging leaders to think about their capacity and developing their capacity to take inputs from people that are different than them, to be able to have productive meetings with people at a table that may not even speak the same language, right? And thinking about how to navigate and create those kinds of productive collaborations. I think on an individual level, it's about your raising of your self-awareness and your communication style and engaging with the knowledge that already exists in the communities that are already vocal and welcoming, and expanding your capacity for engaging with people that are different than you. If I can share an example, I worked with a company and one of their reps was having an issue and shared an example of a really turbulent conversation they were having with the customer. They called someone, a small business, cold call, and it happened to be a Jamaican-owned business, and the gentleman on the line was speaking Patois. And the rep that called on them didn't understand what the gentleman was saying. And the knee-jerk reaction was to hang up the phone. Imagine that experience of, from the customer's perspective, having your day interrupted, someone trying to sell you something, and then making no effort to even understand you. Imagine from the rep's perspective, feeling like I've completely failed at what I do, and I didn't have the tools to even respond or react, right? Those are the things that we have to consider in terms of customer engagement. And when we develop strategies, when we develop training programs, or even design product and services, we have to make those kinds of considerations for making sure that everyone has the experience that they deserve in these instances.
Yeah, I got it. It's very interesting. And you mentioned something that is so important for sales, namely the playbook. Yeah. That the playbook actually is something that is really worked out well. How do you go into such planning and work out of a playbook? And how important is it really for the sales?
It's incredibly instrumental for two reasons. Number one, if something works in terms of driving conversions and revenue for a business, a certain way of engaging the customer works, you want to replicate what works as many times as possible in the company. The way you do that is by capturing in detail the process, methodology, and approach. I think that the playbook not only standardizes performance and customer experience, but I think the playbook also is something that alleviates anxiety from everyone's experience, right? The anxiety of a sales rep showing up with confidence, they have answers, they have tools, and they have a methodical approach for controlling and containing conversation. The customer isn't going to be surprised by anything because they're going to have a buying experience where the next step is very clearly articulated, each step that they take in the process, right? A playbook allows for that ironing out of that experience on both ends. And so it's going to be really critical, I would say, if you haven't thought about it. Sales is a very predictable process, right? And so if you don't have a predictable process, I would say that's your cue. If it's not predictable and scalable and repeatable, and that's your cue to implement a playbook.
One thing that is so hard for salespeople, and I fully can understand this, is to get the budget from the customer. How to do that?
You do that up front. So if I were to jump on a call with someone, like you came to me, Norbert, and you were like, hey, I've got a sales team. We're not performing where we need to perform. I think we would benefit from having strategy, structure, training, and things in place. And we need this to happen before end of year. Great, Norbert, question for you. You said you want this done by end of year, so you have your sense of time. Talk to me, how much are you looking to invest to get this done? What are your non-negotiables around that investment? Before I ever talk about my pricing, you're telling me, well, you know, I've got $10,000 to get this done. That puts me in a position to say, you know what, this is what I can do within that budget, or this budget won't help. The only way we'll make impact is at 50,000 plus. And this is why. And so that's how you can avoid a situation where you're backed into a corner. Is just ask upfront, what are you willing to invest to get this done?
Today, I'm talking to Federico, who has a really rich background across various sales roles. And he thinks that buyers prioritize solutions, not internal sales processes. And I think that's the truth, Federico, but please tell us more about yourself.
I think my role, of course, spans across the multiple areas. So starting my career in sales, particularly B2B sales, working with mostly within the software space, SaaS, and just more general like technology. At the moment, I'm the director of sales enablement at GetAccept, which is a focused on in the sales tech industry. But in short, my focus is always about understanding how a company can build structures, processes, and just in general, a sales architecture that allows for the upskilling of salespeople in a consistent manner across the board.
Most of the companies don't have a process. They don't have, they just, it comes in, you make an offer, you send it out, you call afterwards. That's a used scenario. What does all those different patterns mean for companies? How could they really push the sales into other directions? And at which point does it make sense to implement something like cold outreach or cold calls or whatever to increase the growth?
I think you need to take a step back and first understand, okay, what type of service you're selling, right? So if you're describing to me something where someone comes inbound, then you have a first conversation and then you might do a follow-up after that, that sounds to me quite somewhat transactional selling in that case, right? So you might have a very short sales cycle.
Yep.
If that's the case, and you have a lot of inbound, short sales cycle, often, you know, having a, like a clear methodology, let's say, that it might not be required to the extent that I've described it, right? But let's take a case which is slightly more complex, where, for example, you're having an inbound, and then you have to go through multiple steps, despite that the company might have already a need and might have a budget for it, but still they have to involve so many other stakeholders, other people have to evaluate things, maybe from a technical perspective. Then the question becomes, how do you streamline that process and make it more systematic? I think from that perspective, I think the first thing that you will have to focus as an organization is understanding what types of inbound you're getting and what are the types of buyer that are more likely to come through your door, and really build playbooks around that to allow your sellers to fully understand the world of the buyer. Because if they understand truly who they're speaking to, they are able to empathize a lot more with them and also approach the conversation in a way where they can be perceived as a trusted advisor. And I think that's what what organization can do. So if you're having inbound leads, and you probably can easily understand what type of inbound leads is, I think most organizations will understand more or less what is their ICP. And if they're not, I would really suggest at some point of their maturity level to really figure that out. Once they're segmenting those, it's about training the sales team to understand, okay, when you're speaking with this type of people, that's their world, that's what they care about, these are the metrics, et cetera, et cetera, so that they can approach that conversation from a different angle, right? They can ask better questions. And in general, if you think about it, when you know someone, the quality of the question you will ask, it goes higher because you are more relevant. There is more resonance with your process. If you're building a sales team, then you want to start thinking, having a multi-channel approach, right? So it's a mix of using the phone, email, and LinkedIn perhaps, and understanding how do you create sequences that leverage all these three areas, and you equip your sellers with the skills to be able to execute in those areas. A lot of companies maybe use only one channel. Maybe they go all in just email. But the thing is that there are types of buyers that will never respond to you by email, no matter how good is the email, right? But some buyers will respond to the phone. If you get them on the phone, they are happy to talk. You know, they just want to do things more quicker. I don't have time to respond to your email. Other people will respond to your LinkedIn, for example. So the multi-channel approach allows you to reach more buyers and at least engage in that first conversation.
There are also a lot of tools involved when it comes to sales. And with ChatGPT or with AI in general, with increasing of integration and automation of the sales process, in which direction is this going? And do we even need a human approach still, or can we automate a lot of things?
Now, what I foresee for the future is that AI already slowly starting to replace, for example, some of the tasks that an SDR, a sales development representative, will do, like the aspect of setting up a meeting, right? A first meeting, right? So for example, you might receive, an inbound lead. In the future, potentially, you might see a situation where basically you will have an AI agent that will call the actual customer and have that very short conversation because it's capable of doing that and setting up the first meeting. Then after the first meeting would be then handled by an actual person, right? So you might see that. So I foresee for the future that maybe some of the role, part of the role, or even in some occasion when you're selling transactional products, you would see maybe the SDRs being potentially replaced. And that means that you will have just, for example, account executives that handle the rest of the process, right? However, when it comes to more complex, we're talking especially, and of course, you think about B2B complex solutions, right? That will be, of course, a lot more difficult. In that case, especially because you're interacting with multiple stakeholders within the prospect business, it requires a lot more strategic thinking, a lot more interaction. Therefore, AI won't replace that because, of course, relationship building is at the core of B2B sales, right? It's about relationship. It's about people ultimately. Instead, in more transactional sales, also B2C, more with consumers, you might see the uptake of AI even farther.
Two things that I want to ask is, and this is so typical, every kind of business has the biggest mistakes you can make. What is the biggest three mistakes or one or two, three mistakes that are done typically in sales?
A lot of companies think that tools are the things that solve problems. The truth is that problems stems not from tools. It's always a change management problem that might be in the organization. There is always a people problem in most cases, and there is a collaboration problem. And then also processes as well. So what I recommend to companies that you have a problem, instead of looking at a tool, first figure out what's the process that will help solve the problem, right? Identify what's the right process that we need to put in place. Then within that process, if a tool will help, then you get a tool. But don't go the route of I first get the tool and then I figure out the rest. Because I've seen that in GoCarless previously, loads of tools are brought in the organization as the company has got cash. But the reality is that you don't have capacity to enable the use of the tool in the organization. So you're having tools that are standing there, no one is using them. And that's a typical problem of organization I also see.
Today I have Bish. Tell me a bit about yourself, about your company. What are you doing?
I am founder of a company called Enigmatic Smile, which is what we call a reward technology facilitator. So we facilitate more effective loyalty programs across the world and for multiple businesses, both in-store and e-commerce businesses.
How important is nowadays a well-structured loyalty program? How do you see that?
I think sometimes, Norbert, I can be a little bit controversial around this subject matter because I approach this from the perspective of Coca-Cola. Yeah, this is my little story I come up with sometimes. If you go to a restaurant and you say, can I have a Coke? 50% of those restaurants will say, sure, and give you a Coke. And the other 50% will ask this exact question. Sorry, we don't have Coke, it's Pepsi. Is that okay? And every single time your answer is, sure. And that kind of creates a situation.
That's true. I never thought about that.
Yes. So basically, the exact words are, sorry, we have Pepsi. Is that okay? And we all will just say yes. And then you go, well, where is the loyalty in that? Because I ask for a Coke, but I'll accept a Pepsi. And I think that's the same everywhere. Where's my loyalty? I can only get what I can get sometimes. Loyalty is a question of, is it just a question sometimes that there isn't even any loyalty? It's just whatever's available, I'll get. So the question of loyalty and well-structured loyalty programs is much more around what can we do for a customer to make their experience as best as possible and as easy as possible to get them to want to buy from us as much as possible in the easiest way possible and keep reminding them to come back and keep buying from us whenever they have some money to spare. So the importance of that, my goodness, without it, a brand can be losing 25%, 30% of their chances to get to a customer from the perspective of being able to reach out to that customer base and incentivize them to come back better, faster and better than their competitors can. But that's obviously a huge thing. So to get new customers, to get return customers, and to keep getting that customer incentivizing to buy more in a kind of personalized way, I think is becoming more and more important, mainly because everyone else is doing it. So if somebody's not doing it and not doing it well, they're going to be losing money and nobody wants to do that, right?
That's true, but you also pointed out something that I want to dive in a bit. You said everyone is doing it and that's the truth. And the question is, I hate it if I need to register for another loyalty program. The benefits you get are most benefits that are set very high. So you need to do a lot to even achieve them. So it's not attractive and you're just in another loyalty program. You need actually actively maintain that. How do you solve the problem?
Right now, so now we get into really...
From a user perspective.
Yeah, we get into really interesting directions. And it almost verges on philosophy sometimes because you need to unwrap this problem in a really comprehensive way. And let's look at it. Like a few years ago, I had a friend called Paul. And he used to be part of this kind of points program where every time he got the train, he would get some point. And he would travel to London and back and London and back and London and back and spend 30, 40 pounds every single day to get these trains. And at the end of the year, he had got enough points to buy a Don't Mess With The Zohan DVD. What is that? He didn't want a Don't Mess With The Zohan TV. He didn't care about it. And maybe his needs at the time were to buy, a Mariah Carey CD. Yeah, but he couldn't get the Mariah Carey CD because the retailer had determined that what they wanted to get rid of was the Don't Mess With The Zohan DVD. And of course, the points could suddenly expire or the retailer could go bust or a million other things that made that experience of Paul bad. And in fact, because it was such a bad experience, it probably put him off the retailer that he would have otherwise, if they'd run a better program, be more interested in. Loyalty programs can actually have the opposite effect for the customer base if you look at it from solely the retailer's perspective. So you're quite right. Looking at from the customer's perspective is the only solution. And the only solution to that is thinking, as a customer, what do I want? What do you want? I want as much free money as I possibly can have anytime I'm going shopping in as many places as possible without having to do anything, without having to say anything, without having to check in, without having to print coupons, without having to research codes. I don't want to do anything at all. And I want to know I have an accumulation of value that I can use back with specific brands. And if you look at it at that really fundamentally base perspective of what a human being wants, the rewards have to be strong enough and fungible, this word fungible, usable in many different places, as possible in order for me to be motivated or bother being involved. So how do you solve that? The way to solve it, or the first way we determined to solve it, was by tying normal payment methods to the transaction. So when I just register my card in any publisher app or any, in the same way as you would have an affiliate network being a publisher for the retailer, we would run reward programs where it could be, as I said, a bank or any large organization, where they would onboard all of their customers by telling their customers, register their debit cards, credit cards, every payment method they have. And then every single time those customers use any of their payment methods, the reward is automatically tracked, where the customer gets the same value, like a cashback, in one location. And then the customer can take that reward and then reuse it back at any of the participating brands.
What are then the most common mistakes that e-commerce businesses make when they implement a loyalty program?
It's more along the lines of thinking about it from only their perspective. So someone picks up the phone and says, hey, why don't you implement this strategy? And someone in the brand's like, okay, let's give that a shot. And then instead of it, maybe it starts off at, say, a 10% reward. And then they go, okay, you know what? I only want to pay 10% if the customer spends 50 euros. And then it turns into, oh, but if the customer spends too much money, I don't want to give away too much reward. So I want to cap the reward at 10 euros per transaction. And then it goes, if the customer has already shopped with me before, I want to give them actually less. And they start putting all these rules around the system that eventually makes the customer not interested. And it reverts to the same idea of looking for coupons and all this stuff. Or activating offers. Yeah. Why should I have to activate an offer? I'm not interested. Why should I have to? I don't know. There's a million different things where they're quite interesting. And these things like spinning the wheel. So you spin the wheel and maybe you get an offer at the brand, or everybody wins at some sort of deal. That's quite interesting as some sort of gamification to try something straight away. But it doesn't solve the problem of maintaining that long-term relationship with the customer and bringing them back and back again. So imagine if you're a brand and every customer who's ever shopped with you, you can just send a push message onto their phone on their birthday, or automatically on their birthdays, if they shopped at another brand, if they haven't shopped with you for 3 months, a push message appears on the phone within the apps of the banks and the media companies and any other publishing networks, where they're all coming back to you as a customer. We need to solve the problem of impulsing someone to buy more right there and then, and we need to solve the problem of reaching back out to them to get them coming back in again. And if you can make the currency itself the hook to bring them back again, that's where the win happens.
Do you see any future trends? How and where does this go to?
I think the whole, we're in almost a schizophrenic way at the moment on a giant level. One side of it is, I want my privacy back. I want control of my life back. I want control of my, you know, I'm like a guy maybe who just doesn't buy into the globalist agenda. And then you've got another group of people who are completely bought into doing everything that the world tells them to do. And they're two very different groups of people. So from the highest perspectives, those two groups are what we're aiming for as a customer base. And what you do for one doesn't work for the other. So having a solution where the customer bases themselves have the rewards that they can get at the most places possible in the best, easiest way for them, where they're in control of their data, that resonates with both of those groups. So in terms of future trends, you have this fight on between cryptocurrencies and the traditional value frameworks, between data sharing and no data sharing, between regulation, between all of this stuff that's everywhere, is turning into a massive war. And at the end of the day, the retailer or the brands that you're dealing with either going to win or fail based on how they respond to the end user's needs, within all of that data frameworks and regulation and all of that stuff that's happening. Just simplify it down to, hey, come here. Every time you come back, every time you shop with me, I'll give you 10% credit and you can come back and use the 10% credit. And you're not restricted. You've not got rules. You've not got complications. And you know what? I recognize that if you want to send that credit to somebody else, then that other person will come back and use the credit at my store. And that's good for me. It's not that I only want you. Share that credit around, move it around, build more collaboratively, think more holistically that your business is part of an economy of our countries, but also we can build a smaller economy, which is more focused around bringing people back to your business. And obviously the value of an economy within an economy can be amplified by being smaller, a smaller group of brands within it, rather than every single brand that's out there in the world. So that's where I think we're headed.
Today, I'm talking to Paul Jarrett, the CEO and co-founder of Bulu. Paul, tell us a bit about yourself and about Bulu.
We work with tons of big, cool brands, but now we just say at Bulu, we do the tricky ship, as in shipments. None of that cursing words for you potty mouths there. So yeah, at Bulu, we focus on doing the tricky ship. And what that means is really for the past, we started about 12 years ago. My spouse, who happens to be my co-founder, and I can say it's my wife, Stephanie, we've worked together at it, and we've done everything from our own consumer packaged goods brands to building and selling a software to working with big brands. And now really, we have a new chapter of our company where we're just really focused on equalizing the playing ground in e-commerce and helping smaller people do the same thing that the bigger folks are doing.
With the rise of subscription services, actually, how has the fulfillment landscape changed over the years?
Yeah, I would say that what I have seen, and it's still shocking to me. So when we started, I think you'll find this really interesting. We made the conscious effort to use Shopify, but this is 12, 13 years ago. And there wasn't a lot of people on Shopify. And we used to call all the time trying to get stuff fixed. And we talked to Toby in customer service. Toby was actually the CEO and we didn't know. So I was getting firsthand conversations, discussions with the CEO of Shopify. Wow. And he would always tell me, Paul, we're going to have a marketplace someday. I really think you should focus on building a subscription app because what we have, it's kind of hacky. It's not working. And I was like, whatever, man. What does this guy in customer service know? But what I see changing, or what I'm surprised, is that a couple of years after that, we thought there would be plenty of options. And we thought that by now, there would be plenty of good options for digital and physical solutions with subscription. And to this day, I'm just shocked that, and I've noticed a lot of people, I would say I'm shocked at how slow the industry actually moves. And there's so many little things holding it back. Like, we've spent a lot of money in research trying to understand, will people call it subscription or auto renew, right? And it was subscription about 6 months ago. And now we're starting to see a lot of people call it auto renew. And so little things like that really add up, and it takes a lot of time and money to understand the market. And I would say I am still absolutely shocked at how terrible most fulfillment companies are with basic subscription, gifting, membership. And then to add returns onto that, it's really mind-blowing how simple we believe and see and do that. Yet in the industry, people think it's impossible to sell a subscription out of a retail store. And you're like, we do it for Disney. It's not really actually that hard. So I would say that's really surprising at how slow the industry is and how even nowadays people don't understand the value of subscription. And it's probably the number one thing CEOs in any logistics software or any other company talk to me about. And my only response is there needs to be more money educating the market on what it actually means. And everybody should have a subscription product on their website. If you gave me any company, I could say that should be on subscription or they should add a product. Cleaners are a great thing, right? Whatever you buy, sell a cleaner with it and sell it on subscription at checkout. So a lot of folks, I think, are missing that. And one little tweak to their website and one good partner, all of a sudden, you know, I say subscription should be looked at as paying your electricity and your utility bills, right? Don't look at it as a solution. It's just a tool that you need in your toolbox.
What sets subscription box fulfillment apart from the typical e-commerce fulfillment? I mean, it's just a renewing order and you just pack it again every month, isn't it?
Here's kind of how I would describe it to people with a physical product. Okay, I got my AirPods here, right? Let's just say it's one item and it's going to go out. What I need, of course, I'm probably preaching to the choir. I need the digital information and the physical information to follow through whatever pipeline it goes through. And even if it comes back, I need that information to stay together, right? Now, imagine the part where there's actually this and there's actually this piece, right? And there's all these pieces that go together to make up this product, right? So now, is it an individual item or is it a subscription or item like an inventory, right? And what we see is a lot of people don't understand that really a subscription box, it's just multiple varied items kitted or bundled together as one and shipped on a recurring basis. And when and if those things come back, the whole mechanics for how you track inventory are different, right? So it's this mindset of the industry saying, here's one item, here's the digital information, here's the physical information. They flow throughout and we're done. That's not where it is anymore, right? It's here's the digital, here's the physical. Let's get all the pieces of the digital thing so we can keep our inventory and our manufacturing closer together. Okay, these are going to go through. Is it going physical to retail? Is it going to distribution center? Is it going to customers' doors? There's a gazillion channels that it can go through. It's got to flow through there as an auto-renew subscription gift or whatever. And it has to come back and the customer data has to come back. And that infinite loop of really what I would say intensely managing APIs to ensure that the data flows correctly, it really starts to look like a data management company mindset. And so I'm just fascinated that people are still stuck in this. I'm going to sell a product and make 60, 70, 80, 90% margin, or I'm going to drop ship and fight for this 10%. I'm like, no. You're going to do all of it through all the locations, and you will respect the margin for each one of those things, and you will grow at a pace that's manageable because we're actually going to track the inventory, and you will know 24/7, 365, where every single thing is at. And the moment anybody at our company touches, moves, zaps it, we're tracking every single little piece. And when you start to look at it like almost user interface design, you can see glaringly all of the problems in the industry. And that's how we look at it. We'll see if we're right, but so far it's been pretty good.
Mentioned all this, how do you ensure that a subscription box is not just a monthly delivery, but an actual experience for the customer?
Yeah, so we say when it comes to a subscription, I'm actually going to just grab a piece of one right over here. So we said, so this is the Shark Week box. This was one item that was in it. We had candy, we had this, we had this really fun, there's actual squishy sand, on kinetic sand, I believe it's called, right? And what we find with our clients is we call it marketing like a pirate. And when you look at, and that's from Dave McClure, 500 Hats, hat tip to Dave. What we found is a subscription box can really be utilized in five different ways. You can, and we call it marketing like a pirate because the acronym is R, right? Mm-hmm. So you can acquire new customers by doing an interesting box. You can activate customers to do a specific thing, right? You can also make a revenue off of it, which is important, right? But use it for a referral program. And you can always use it for a retention for like employees. So there's kind of these different things. And what we talk to brands about is, look, Disney, for example. This box can be used to do these different things. We call it marketing like a pirate. But if you focus in on one thing specifically, we know how to build the box around that. So let's say that we want to cover acquisition or any one of those things, right? We look at the box and we know that we need products in a subscription box. And this is by data science, PhDs, Boston University, Harvard, that we hired, paid way too much money. And they put words to what we thought, right? They looked at all of our data and they said, a great subscription box or any delivery for that matter, based on the data, means that when somebody opens it, they should be able to feel something. And not even just emotionally, but physically. Can they feel the crinkle paper? Is there an interesting product in there, kinetic sand that they can take out and feel? So feel is number one. Taste, smell is number two. Can they smell it? Like Crayola, we had like fake Crayola spray in it. So it smelled like crayons to people. So feel, taste, or smell, those two things like lock people in. And then we say, what's the wow product? As in, wow, I didn't realize they're giving that to me. Or wow, that's a lot of something. Or wow, I never knew a heat-activated shark mug existed. And then really the last two products we say are weight, which means they're used to control the weight of the box. So if you have the feel, the taste and the smell, the wow factor, and then anything else in there is really used to control the weight of the box. You want it under 2 pounds, pro tip. That's really what makes a great subscription. And that can be one product or it can be 100 products. But those, that's what's actually going through somebody's mind when they open up the box from you. So it's super valuable to think about that experience versus a giant Amazon box with ChapStick in the middle of it.
And guys, if you liked it, hit the like button, give a review, and come back for the next episode. See you then. Bye-bye.
And that's it for this episode of the Ecom Ops Podcast. If you enjoyed listening and would like us to find and interview more e-commerce operations experts, please search for Ecom Ops Podcast in your favorite podcast listening app, and then subscribe, rate, and review. Until next time.